content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family, and we wish to thank them for their support. And I've got a couple articles here. Here's one called Catch the Wind. This innovative craft taught millions of Americans to seize the breeze, by Kate Wheeling. It's the platonic ideal of the sailboat, unmistakable in lakes and coastal waterways across the country, with its colorful equilateral triangle sail pulled taut in the summer breeze. It's also the most popular sailboat ever made, with more than 500,000 built since the first launch came in 1952. The design of the Sunfish came from Cortland Heiniger and Alex Bryan, friends whose company, Alcort, was building a rescue paddleboard for the Red Cross. On a whim, Bryan added a simple sail to the wooden board to create a basic but eloquent sailboat. As legends holds, his wife, Aileen Bryan Nee Shields, a sailing scion of the racing champion, tried sailing the craft and wanted a little more room to maneuver, as she was then pregnant. So Alcort's first employee, Carl Meinert, designed a cockpit for the Sunfish, drawing the first mock-up in dust on the floor of Alcort's wood shop in Waterbury, Connecticut. The first Sunfish was built in the early 1950s. The first models were wood and measured just under 14 feet long. They sold for less than $200, roughly $2,200 in today's money, and could be launched right from the beach without a dock, making the Sunfish an accessible and affordable fixture at vacation houses across the United States. The Sailfish also opened up the world of sailboat racing to those who could not afford yachts and club memberships. 1963 saw the first North American championship for Sunfish racers, and the first Sunfish World Championship was held in the U.S. Virgin Islands in 1970. The boat's simplicity meant winning was truly a testament to one's skills. As one Sunfish dealer told the New York Times in 1970, racing one puts a lot on the man or woman, adds Lee Parks, a two-time winner of the Women's North American National Championship. Unlike some other classes, the Sunfish class is male and female. It's multi-generational. Anybody can sail them. In 1977, Fortune magazine named the boat one of America's 25 best-designed products. The Sunfish designers were inducted into the Sailing Hall of Fame in 2021. Sunfish enthusiasts, whether casual sailors or serious racers, are known for their sportsmanship. According to Parks, every event you go to is like a family reunion. And now we go on to another article, Bright Light. A candle stand used by the first president illuminates his extraordinary last days in office. This is by Alexis Coe. George Washington was a man of many talents. Writing speeches was not one of them. He wasn't great at delivering speeches either, and he was thin-skinned. Washington managed each of those imperfections on its own, but when he had to contend with all three at once, he struggled to maintain his legendary self-control. Such moments of apparent weakness are a gift, not so much for him as for me, one of his biographers poignantly. They bring Washington to life. If Washington had his way, he never would have been president. My movements to the chair of government will be accompanied with feelings not unlike those of a culprit who is going to the place of his execution, he wrote to a well-wisher in an uncharacteristically rueful moment ahead of the first inauguration. After leading the country to victory in the Revolution, Washington had happily given up power, but his fellow framers argued that he'd be implicitly agreed to be the president's first president by presiding over the 1787 Constitutional Convention, and in 1788 they pressured him out of retirement. On April 30, 1789, Washington took the oath of office at Federal Hall in New York City and delivered a 10-minute inaugural address to Congress. In their letters, legislators noted that the hero of the Revolution was clearly nervous, and he was, but he was also annoyed with the pomp. He wanted to get to work. Washington dutifully spent the next 4 years on a precedent-setting bender. Satisfied, he tasked James Madison, his close advisor and later the fourth president, with drafting a farewell address. Once again, his fellow founders stepped in. Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and Thomas Jefferson prevailed on Washington to serve a second term. After winning unanimous re-election from the Electoral College, Washington found the next 4 years excruciating, and part of it was his fault. Washington, who claimed no political party, wrote to Jefferson, "The first wish of my heart was, if parties did exist, to reconcile them." Ironically, Washington hastened the development of partisanship when he invented the cabinet and offered Jefferson, a Democrat, Republican, and Hamilton, a Federalist, prime spots in it. Should America remain neutral in foreign wars? Were its debts excessive? Who would pay taxes? Jefferson and Hamilton's bitter arguments spilled into the newspapers, horrifying the president. His name, Washington complained to Jefferson, was bandied about the papers in such exaggerated and indecent terms as could scarcely be applied to a Nero, a notorious defaulter, or even a common pickpocket. Critics, anonymous and otherwise, inveighed against his foreign and domestic policies and his leadership as monarchical and aristocratic. By 1796, he wanted out. Now 64, Washington had outlived all the men in his family and did not wish to die in office, which would set a truly monarchical precedent. In the past, Washington would have summoned his ghostwriters, but some of the most literary founders had left government, or else he wished they had. Hamilton was practicing law in New York, while Jefferson had left the cabinet, but was still acting surreptitiously as the chief instigator of anonymous and anti-Washington propaganda. And Madison, who had written a draft of a farewell address, was aligned with Jefferson. The president, whose formal schooling had ended when he was 14, worked on the draft himself. According to Eleanor Nellie Custis, a step-granddaughter whom Washington raised, the president labored over Madison's draft for days. Whenever the sun set, a shiny brass candlestand, which entered the Smithsonian collection, in 1883 would allow him to work well into the night with a homemade quill. He applied a heavy hand to the speech. It would serve as the last will and testament of his presidency. His first draft included such harsh words for Washington's detractors that Hamilton felt compelled to step in. He advised the president to embrace such reflections and sentiments as well as will wear well progress in approbation with time and redound to future reputation. Washington took Hamilton's notes and finished the speech, but would not deliver it to Congress. It wasn't for them. It was for the American people. In September 1796, 6 months before he would leave office, Washington submitted the 6,000-word address to the American Daily Advertiser, a relatively independent publication in an era otherwise defined by partisan journals. He called it a warning from a parting friend. By the following year, after Washington had done what he did best, give up power, the speech had been reprinted in more than 100 newspapers. The farewell address became, for a century or more, the most popular undelivered speech in history. Students read it in school. Patriots memorized portions of it for resuscitation. And to honor Washington's birthday, the two parties in the U.S. Senate take turns each year in reading it aloud. Washington couldn't predict the future, but a half century of public service left him with enough wisdom to fashion a shockingly modern document. It is our true policy to steer clear of any permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world, he wrote, concerned that America would be dragged into battles with nations when it would do better to be trading with them. His greatest concern, however, was partisanship and the prospect of an authoritarian ruler. Political factions, he said, inclined the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. The leader would use this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. Washington's message was this mandate: we must guard our inheritance. If we allow sectional jealousies to eclipse national interests, the public will be in peril. Wow, that was something we should all read. And we jump over to another short article called Here Be Monsters, a clever Setterson feeding trick may have launched a whale of a legend by Nina Goldman. This is under the heading Zoology. The creature was enormous. Sailors said it looked more like an island than a fish. When feeding, according to a 13th century Old Norse manuscript, the beast known as the Hafgufa would rest with its mouth open wide, luring in unsuspecting fish, then snap its jaws shut to capture them. Hair-raising accounts of a similar sea monster were recorded by Alexandrian scribes as early as the 2nd century A.D. These accounts spread throughout Europe and Asia in Arabic, Coptic, Latin, and Old English translations. Now researchers argue the mighty Hafgufa and similar sea monsters, I should spell that word, might not be pronouncing it correctly, H-A-F-G-U-F-A, and similar sea monsters described by the ancients were not mythical creatures, but rather whales engaged in a behavior that was only recently documented, trap feeding. In 2011, marine biologists studying whales in the wild first observed trap feeding, in which whales, notably humpbacks, float motionless at the water's surface with their mouths agape. The link to ancient legends was forged by John McCarthy, a marine archaeologist at Australia's Flinders University, which became intrigued by the old local sagas and the Hafgufa, which excavating a shipwreck off the coast of Iceland. Working with medievalist colleagues at Flinders, McCarthy uncovered further instances in which ancient humans apparently observed the same sneaky feeding behavior and attributed it to sea monsters. They argue these Greek and Norwegian bestiarians are evidence that this supposedly novel crustacean hunting strategy could be much older than marine biologists had known. Some critics argue that these ancient accounts, with their fanciful illustrations, are too outlandish to be used as scientific evidence. Still, McCarthy and others contend that trap feeding could have been more commonly observed before industrial whaling nearly obliterated many whale populations, because back then whales faced more competition for food and may have tried experimental hunting techniques, and because our ancestors simply came across whales more frequently. It's estimated there were more than 100,000 North Atlantic humpbacks before the 17th century, but fewer than 1,000 by 1955. The ancients would have witnessed seas really teeming with whales, McCarthy notes, and thus were more likely to encounter the feeding behavior. Now, with populations growing again thanks to the conservation efforts, some scientists estimate North Atlantic humpbacks have rebounded 20-fold since 1955. The researchers argue whales may be returning to old habits described by our ancestors. Henry Huntington, a researcher for Ocean Conservancy, says the team's argument is strong and particularly commends their methodology. Taking old sources seriously is a welcome approach. And there's a drawing of a whale, which its head looks more like a pig. And there's a little line here, a 1658 map of Iceland, reprinted from Abraham Ortelius Theatrum Orbis Terium, which includes a sea monster known for catching its fish through cunning. And we pause. The Art of War, a veteran's painstaking tribute to naval might and sacrifice, by Isabel Spiegel. A few minutes past midnight on July 30, 1945, two Japanese torpedoes struck the 10,000-ton USS Indianapolis. In just over 10 minutes, it went under. For more than 3 days, sailors battled shark attacks, dehydration, and salt poisoning. Only 316 of the 1,196 crewmen survived. When J.D. Smith finished his drawing of the Indianapolis in 2019, he took a drive past a burial ground for veterans in Los Angeles and wept, thinking about those who had died on the ship. When I feel I've captured the ship and its essence, enough for the crew of that ship to say, "Okay, this representation is our ship," that's when I get the tears, he says. Over the past 15 years, Smith has dedicated himself to creating some of the world's most intricate and evocative renderings of battleships that fought in the Pacific Theater in World War II. Smith comes from a long line of veterans and served in the Navy himself as a boiler room technician on an amphibious assault ship. from 1981 to 1984. He's a self-taught artist, so skilled a draftsman that he can still replicate the diagram of the engine room of the vessel where he served. A pipe fitter by day and historian by night, he employs pen, pencil, and collage. Growing up in the Venice neighborhood of Los Angeles, he spent much of his childhood on the San Pedro and Wilmington docks with his grandfather, who worked as a hydrostatic welder, repairing battleships during World War II. A cousin of Smith's stepdad was one of the youngest sailors who died aboard the USS Astoria at the Battle of Savo Island in 1942. Hearing that story prompted Smith's obsession with naval tragedies, and every ship he has depicted since has been an act of commemoration. These men didn't have gravestones. They got coordinates, Smith says. Whether he's recreating a Japanese or a U.S. ship, Smith's attention to detail is an homage to the men who walked those decks, ate in those mess halls, and slept in those bunks. Smith pores over reference materials, blueprints, photos, and first-person accounts. To immerse himself in a ship's structure and role in the war, he considers every element of the ship's composition down to its position in the water on a given day or the angle of a shadow. Among the other vessels he has drawn are the USS North Carolina, the USS Essex, the ING Musashi, and the IJN Nagato, and the IJN Gaga. Though he works largely outside the public eye, his first solo show, Unforgotten, is currently on view at the Alpha Romeo Tango Gallery at the Battleship USS Iowa Museum in Los Angeles. For Smith, the Indianapolis is particularly emblematic of the horrors of war. 4 days before encountering that Japanese missile, the crew had unknowingly delivered the internal components for the atom bomb that would destroy Hiroshima and kill between 70 and 140,000. I draw the ships without any bias, Smith says. Japanese casualties were more numerous almost every time. Death is pretty final. We're all in that same sense. That was a sobering article. And we'll finish up with Bisa Butler's portrait of Harriet Tubman, which began with a minuscule black and white carte de visite, whatever that means. The 19th century photograph featured the famed Underground Railroad conductor when she was around 40, about the age Butler was at the time. I blew the photo up, Butler says. Is she looking at me? She is. What would she think of everything that I think I have a hard life? By 2021, Butler's large quilted portrait, I Go to Prepare a Place for You, is the name of it, was hanging in the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Made entirely out of fabric, it portrays Tubman in a kaleidoscope of colors. Her skin is a contrast of cool blues and fiery reds, capturing her need to hide along with her tenacity and courage. The background of sunflower symbolizes the constancy of the North Star as Tubman's unwavering faith. The gold, orange, and green in her skirt suggests her African heritage. A renowned Butler has done for quilt making what Matisse did for paper cutting, elevating a humble technique to a high art. For years, quilting has been dismissed by the fine arts world as decorative craft or domestic labor. Butler's stunning work has helped shatter that barrier. She made her first portrait, Francis and Violet, (parentheses, grandparents), were pursuing a master's in arts education in 2001. Today, her life-size quilts hang in museums across the country. She focuses on people of African descent, but avoids representational skin tone. Her subjects shimmer in bright hues of fuchsia, imperial blue or acid green, with a purple lip, an orange cheekbone, or turquoise temple for emphasis. Butler always begins with a photograph. Her sources vary widely. Farm Security Administration Archives, a 1909 Rufus Holsinger portrait, Janet Beckman's fiercely feminist 1987 photo of rappers Salt and Peppa. The last of these was a suggestion from her husband, John Butler, a longtime professional DJ. She takes time to divine her subjects' spirits, studying their gazes and stances, their clothing and accessories. I grew up looking at my family photos, which were black and white, she says. I was so curious about these people and places I would never know. My maternal grandmother would talk to me about her Louisiana Creole relatives. My father spoke to me about the liberation of Ghana, his birthplace, in 1954, and I wish I had been there. Butler enlarges each image on photo paper, using a Sharpie to delineate light to dark gradation. I use that like a dressmaker's pattern, she says. I cut shapes based off my sketch and layer them until I have an image that is an impression of the original. Over the decades, she has collected snippets and swaths of that material. And that's going to wrap up our reading for today. We run out of time. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed this reading from Smithsonian. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.